Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show. Today, Arrivederci 2020, as we round up all the festive football news you may have missed or put down to food coma hallucination. From Arsenal winning games, to Leeds embarrassing Big Sam like a reporter with a pint of Bordeaux, to the new Moneybags money to Burnley. The movers, the shakers, the circuit breakers. Plus, if you haven't already had plenty from 2020, the most memorable moments of this past year in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
All professional football has been postponed because of the coronavirus outbreak. Here's
where the story ends. The names on players' jerseys replaced with the words Black Lives Matter.
Taking a knee before the game to teach generations what it means to be together and help each other no matter what your race. It's that little souvenir
of a terrible year. Liverpool are your Premier League champions! Oh my God almighty!
The pain, the anguish is over! Scotland are through to Euro 2020!
Yeah. Lionel Messi has requested to leave Barcelona. This is legit, this is real.
Yeah, we in Bayern, we have Robert Lewandowski. You know, Robert Lewandowski.
I would be fighting him at halftime. There's no getting away from that. I would be swinging punches at that guy.
Emma?
90,000.
Jack?
90,001.
Not too worried about these corners. I mean, not sure anyone can get the head on the first ball for Liverpool apart from that.
Oh, Sim!
Hello to you, listener. Yep, here's where the story ends for 2020, December 30th. As we record, this is New Year's Eve Eve. And as this year winds down, we're joined by Duncan Alexander.
Hello, James.
Tom Williams.
Hello, James.
And Adrian Clark.
Howdy.
Howdy to all three of you. Later on, we'll be getting some of your favourite bits of 2020 in an especially short section. But first, there's plenty of news to be catching up on from the last 10 days since our last Totally show. We've had two whole rounds of Premier League action, Carabao Cup quarterfinals, and now a lot of talk after Man City's clash with Everton was called off on Monday because of a COVID-19 outbreak at their training ground. Talk of a circuit breaker, maybe another little mini pause in the season. Who's got the latest on this? Is it actually a real prospect?
It doesn't look like an imminent prospect, but the clubs are obviously talking about it. I think that there's not a huge amount of appetite from the Premier League to suspend the season at the moment, but it does feel a little bit like it felt in the middle of March, when cases started to rise and obviously games were called into jeopardy. And we've seen that with the Everton-Man City game being called off and doubts about other matches. So although it doesn't look like it's going to be announced in the next couple of days, it is concerning. The fact, I mean, you know, we know that cases are rising across the country, so it's no surprise that that's also happening within football. But yeah, it's worrying.
Right. Man City's clash with Everton, only the second Premier League game to be postponed this season. However, nearly 50 matches across the Football League were postponed since Christmas, 9 on Tuesday alone. Are we just an Arteta positive test away from another shutdown then?
Well, I think the difference to the spring is obviously the procedures are in place, the testing is better, and clubs kind of know how to put on a secure match now. But it's basically going to boil down to a choice. Do you pause the season and try and restart it, which is going to be very hard if they want to do the Euros, or you're going to end up with a situation like we, to be fair, used to get a long time ago with certain clubs having a massive backlog of fixtures to get through. I mean, my favourite all time was West Brom in 1912, who played on April the 20th, the FA Cup final, then on April the 22nd, and then the replay of the Cup final on April the 24th, then on April the 25th, then on April the 26th, then on April the 27th, and then a day's break before playing on April the 29th. They didn't win any of those games, which I'm, you know, I'm no sports scientist, but they might have been a bit tired.
That's incredible. That is unbelievable. I think the individual managers... Well, Sam Allardyce made a really good point. He said, look, I'm 66 years of age. I don't particularly feel safe. The last thing I want to do is contract COVID-19. And obviously, Roy Hodgson is even older. And he, you know, he has to be considered in one of the more vulnerable categories. So you have to think about the individuals. It might not be an Arteta type case where someone high profile gets it. It could be the fact that a high profile name refuses to carry on. It could be that, just for their own safety. They say, no, I'm going to step aside because I need to shield a family member, etc. That could easily happen. And I'm a little bit surprised it hasn't until this point.
Well, the EFL and Premier League say there's no discussions yet about pausing or suspending the season. As you say, the measures are already in place. The big difference to back in February, March of this year. And I guess the other question is how much difference it would actually make. Like, how long would you have to suspend it for the situation to be different in a meaningful sense when you started back up again? Fingers crossed anyway that with all due regard to everybody's safety, things do continue, because it's pretty good having the football while everything else is shut down. With that in mind, we're looking back a little bit today on what's been going on since our last show, and also forward to the weekend's action. And let's first off catch up on the big stories in the last 10 days. Boxing Day, round 15 of the season. While Leicester and Man United drew 2-2 and Fulham produced another clean sheet with Saints, the big story was the Arsenal-Chelsea game. The Saka, Shaka, Laka, Ramalana, Ding Dong. Arsenal bouncing back from their 5-1 collapse at home to Man City by nudging the baton of crisis club Chelsea's way. Sunday then saw Bielsa's Leeds out Burnley. Jose's Spurs tried the same trick with Wolves, only to blow it at the last minute. And in scenes reminiscent of West Brom's laundry room, everyone admiring Big Sam's baggies as they held the champions to a 1-1 draw. Round 16 got underway immediately and featured draws for Palace with Leicester, Chelsea and Villa, and Saints with the Hammers. Burnley beating the Blades, another win for Arsenal, this time at Brighton, and then Leeds, in scenes reminiscent of West Brom's laundry room, finding big holes in Big Sam's baggies for a 5-0 win. Plus, a late victory for Man United over Wolves, which moved them into second place. Wow. Of course, listener, there's more action coming up on Wednesday night, probably, with Spurs due to host Fulham, and Newcastle up against Liverpool, but that's where we are for now. Adrian, may I begin by asking you, Arsenal, back-to-back wins, the kids, a narrow victory at fourth from bottom Brighton. It's a bold new dawn.
Thank goodness for that. Look, they needed it. Mikel Arteta, I think, probably should have been bolder with his team selections earlier. He was kind of forced into leaving Willian and Gabriel out, and Pepe's been sidelined. David Luiz was unwell as well. So he was kind of pushed into the corner where he had to play the younger guys. And boy, did it work. I mean, Martinelli and Smith Rowe injected so much fresh energy and movement and dynamism into the team. It just sparked everybody. It was a great performance against Chelsea. 45 minutes against Brighton was just nondescript. Nothing happened. It was like the old Arsenal, where everybody was standing still, no movement. But in the second half, to their credit, 10 shots on goal, lots of good, fast football. And it was Smith Rowe and Saka again at the forefront. These two kids, let me tell you, are very, very good. And they're going to be around for a long, long time. Smith Rowe is obviously behind Saka in terms of stature and development, even though he's a year older. But talent-wise, there's not too much in it. I think that he's in the process of proving that he's got the temperament and the game intelligence to be able to function at the highest level. So, yeah, much more exciting times for Arsenal. But look, there's plenty more to do.
The Chelsea victory ranks for me as one of the biggest surprises of the campaign so far, particularly because it came just a few days after Arsenal had been humiliated by Man City in a performance so bad their keeper had to delete his Twitter account.
Yeah, or Runison. I don't think we'll be seeing Runison again too soon, sadly. I think he was signed to be a number three and he had an absolute stinker.
What, a left back or something?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I did feel sorry for Runison. It's also weird when you look around football and the number of sort of former Arsenal goalkeepers that there are first choice at other clubs. Obviously, you know, Martinez at Villa, Chesney at Juve, Ospina in France.
Fabianski.
Vito Milone, currently in goal for Monaco.
Even Petr Cech for Chelsea under 23. So, you know, there's a lot of talent that the club have discarded.
But all of whom seem to have upped their games since leaving the Emirates.
Yeah, I'd but they probably weren't ready to be the number one, or they weren't in a position to be number one long term, and it was right for them to move. I just feel that Runison was signed probably as a third choice and that Arsenal had somebody else in mind, maybe Brentford's David Raya as the number two, and it didn't happen. But I'm genuinely frightened in case Bernd Leno gets injured, because Runison, it wasn't just this game, he was very shaky against Dundalk as well. I think it's really, really important for Arsenal to sign somebody in the January window to be a new number two. And I know that sounds really harsh on Runison, but I just feel that it's he's been promoted above his ability really at the moment. And just quickly on that Chelsea game, it was a brilliant performance from Arsenal, but Chelsea were lazy in that game. Frank Lampard was absolutely right to lambast his team. And what stood out for me was the wingers, Pulisic and Werner, did not want to track back at all. And I think Arsenal caught Chelsea on a very good day.
So one win in five now for Chelsea, who then drew 1-1 with Villa at home just after Christmas. They are, Daniel Story pointing out, currently on course for the same kind of number of points they had when Ruud Gullit was their manager back in 96-97. Now, you reckon Frank was right to call out his players, Adrian. A lot of people feeling that that was a step in the wrong direction for the manager of an underperforming side.
Well, I mean, I think every manager has the right to lay into their players, particularly when it comes down to effort. And for me, it was effort in that game. I just felt Chelsea believe that the players, I'm sure that he prepared them properly. I just felt that their attitudes weren't as switched on as they have been in other matches. And if a manager can't have a pop at his players for being work shy, then I think the modern game is completely ruined, isn't it?
Theoretically, at Chelsea, you can't do that, because every time a manager does do that, they've lost the dressing room and, you know, here comes the axe. But none of them have been Frank Lampard before, so it's quite an interesting conundrum. But just as an ex-pro, Adrian, I always find it a bit weird when people say the players were lazy, because surely no professional footballer goes out there and goes, just take it easy for this game, can't be bothered. It must be more to it than that.
It's subconscious, really. You just some days you feel sharper than others. Some days you're just hungrier than others. It's a very hard thing to quantify, but it catches a little bit like a virus.
Right.
When one or two players are sluggish in their approach, then honestly, I've seen it 1,000 times. I've played in matches where it's happened. It just catches throughout the team, and everybody gets into that same mindset. And look, a sharp shock treatment from the gaffer, it can get you out of that.
So, but isn't one of the biggest sources of motivation and making sure that players are intense and not lazy the manager himself? So if you come out publicly and say, well, my players can't be arsed, my players have not been motivated properly, you're the fella who's there to do that. Tom?
For me, Lampard having a go at his players for not trying hard enough felt like a bit of a cop-out. I think if you look at Chelsea's players, particularly some of the new players, yes, Timo Werner, Kai Havertz, are adapting to a new league, a new country, difficult circumstances, you know, the pandemic, all the rest of it, they're going to need time. But I don't get the sense watching Chelsea, and this goes back to last season, that everyone understands what's expected of them. And so I think when you see Werner wandering around looking a little bit lost, it may be an issue of work rate to some extent, but I think it is also a sense that this is a player who's trying to find his feet in the team. And I think if everyone at Chelsea had, if the players at Chelsea had a clearer idea of what was expected of them, and if their roles were more clearly defined, and if they were playing in a slightly more coherent way, I don't think you'd see players wandering around looking as lost as they are. And I, but again, I say that with the fact that there are multiple caveats, given this very unique set of circumstances and the fact that Lampard is trying to integrate so many new players into his team.
Yeah, and also, you know, a lot of the players they brought in are pretty young. Ziyech has done really well. They play much better when he plays. He's a bit older. And pretty much the only man they can really rely on at the moment is Olivier Giroud, who is very much not young. So, yeah, I think it's a work in progress, and that's fine for a lot of clubs, but maybe not Chelsea with the amount of money they've spent and the expectations they've got.
I mean, one saving grace for Lampard is that because this season is so peculiar, teams can get away with slumps in form and not be detached in the table. We've seen that recently with Everton, who started the season brilliantly, then their form fell off a cliff, and they've come back with four straight wins, and as we recorded, back in the top four. And I think that will work in the favour of any manager whose team finds itself sixth, seventh, eighth, or on a bit of a bad run of form. It only takes two or three games to turn things around.
Mm. Well, he may also get a little bit more time to work with his players. If indeed Sunday's game, which is due to happen against Man City, doesn't go ahead because of Man City's ongoing issues with that outbreak of COVID-19 at their training ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And given that City have said that they feel that the outbreak stemmed from a trip to London, and with London in the way it is, you know, even if they're recovering, they're not likely to want to go to London. This is what makes it a very, you know, unusual, fast-moving situation.
Right, much like, you know, Elvis Costello back in the day. Don't want to go to Chelsea. I'll just spell that one out for you. Okay, Arsenal this weekend will attempt to make it three wins in a row when they make the trip to the Hawthorns to take on West Brom. Wow, let's talk about that next.
Welcome back to the ground. Tickets, please. Thank you, madam. And let's see, sir. Oh, sorry, no, you're in Tier 3.
No, I ain't. We're in Tier 2. We're allowed to be here. You can't take away my freedom.
Tier 3 of the stadium over there.
Donut.
What? By the donut stand.
Stadiums might not yet be full, but Paddy Power's offers are at full capacity. If one leg of your 4+4 ACCA lets you down, get a free bet on all football and all markets. Paddy Power.
Max free bet £10. Min odds 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive. Exclude shop bets. T's and C's apply. @BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
All right, Adrian, I know you're pumped for this. West Brom against Arsenal. West Brom, we've given us a flash of the old Big Sam magic with that 1-1 at Anfield, but who then got beaten 5-0 on Tuesday night. Sam Allardyce suffering his heaviest ever home defeat in the Premier League at the hands of Leeds in this case. He's only had a week in charge. Some people would say that, therefore, that 1-1 at Anfield owed as much to Slaven Bilic, who, after all, had also had a 1-1 away at Man City than Sam Allardyce. But, you know, what's your feeling about West Brom as we head into this clash with the Gunners?
Yeah, that magic you speak of, it put Liverpool into a daze, didn't it? They were just bored silly, I think, with the attack versus defence. It was a very strange performance from Liverpool. But yeah, credit should go to West Brom for that. But they were ripped apart, goodness me, by Leeds United. The speed of movement was just too much for them. And he's laid into his players, hasn't he? He's basically said that they're not good enough and that he'll be looking to bring in upgrades in January. I do wonder how that will have gone down in the dressing room. A dressing room that I'm sure will have been quite sad to see Slaven Bilic go. He's the guy, obviously, that steered them towards promotion. So I'm not buying into the theory that Slaven had lost the dressing room and that everyone was welcoming Big Sam with open arms. I think that dressing room will feel very, very low ahead of the Arsenal game. We know what to expect. And against an Arsenal team that struggle to break down low blocks, we're going to see a match here where West Brom have about 25% of possession and Arsenal move the ball around all day. Hopefully from an Arsenal perspective, they can move it quickly to hurt West Brom. If they don't, then it'll be a tough game for them. Big Sam was quite outspoken, wasn't he? I thought it might be a mistake on his part to label Arsenal relegation candidates. Do you remember that a couple of days ago or just a week or so ago when asked about Arsenal? He said, absolutely. That's a terrible impression. But absolutely, they're relegation candidates. Absolutely, they're relegation candidates. I mean, that's going to fire up Arsenal, I think, ahead of this game. I'm sure the players will be reminded of that. And Big Sam doesn't have a good record against Arsenal. I've looked it up. He's only got a worse record against Man United and Man City. He averages 0.76 points per game and has won just 6 of 34 against Arsenal down the years. So this sort of viewpoint that Big Sam teams bloody the nose of Arsenal is kind of, it's still pretty rare.
It's one of those things that gets set in football at a certain point and then people never kind of update it. So basically between 2003 and 2010, he didn't lose a single home game against them, mainly with Bolton, once with Newcastle, once with Blackburn. But yeah, Arsenal did have an issue going to the Reebok when they were in their pomp, but that hasn't been the case since. Although they did win with Palace against them at home. So yeah, I agree with Adrian. It's not, statistically, he's not that great against Arsenal, but you know, metaphorically, he is. So we'll see what happens.
Wow. And since we're talking stats, I think it's worth flagging that in that 5-0 defeat against Leeds that West Brom suffered, Leeds' XG was only 1.34. So it wasn't like West Brom took an absolute pasting. If you look at the goals, we had an all-time great Premier League own goal by Romain Sawyers. A couple of absolute worldies from Alioski and Rafinha. A really nicely worked goal that Jack Harrison scored, and then another goal that I've forgotten. So, yes, a very heavy defeat. Sam Allardyce's heaviest ever home defeat in the Premier League, but there was perhaps a little bit more to it than met the eye.
Right, the biggest Romain own goal since 2016, a lot of people were calling it.
I think for fans of football philosophy, the Leeds win was quite important because as much as you could admire West Brom's display at Anfield, it was very much, you know, negative football. It was very much the Big Sam knows how to kind of overcome these foreign tacticians. So seeing kind of Bielsa, who's kind of the literal opposite in many senses, go to the Hawthorns and run amok was quite pleasing. Obviously then, you know, Leeds, an incredibly attacking team on the pitch, possibly the overly defensive off it, given what happened after the match.
Well, you'll probably enjoy Leeds' next match, which is coming up on Saturday, and sees them visit another of the great tacticians, Jose Mourinho and his Spurs. We'll get onto that very, very shortly, but just to rumble through the 17th round of the season, kind of chronologically, it gets underway on Friday with two other interesting games. Everton taking on West Ham, Memory Lane, David Moyes, all that, and Man United, Villa. Everton, who had moved into second place on the back of four straight Premier League wins ahead of that cancelled game with Man City. Man United have taken over second spot for now, but they haven't conceded, Everton, a goal from open play in the Premier League since switching to that back four entirely made of centre-halves. They've also brought back Sigurdsson to great effect. They did have, as Tom was mentioning at the start, a run like this at the beginning of this campaign, and then they looked absolutely rotten not long after. So can we take them seriously this time?
Against West Ham, yeah, I think so. I mean, as you say, fantastic form of late, four straight wins, extra time to prepare after the postponement of their game against Man City. Might be able to welcome some players back. I know Richarlison was expected to miss that game because of the concussion a protocol that he's following, so maybe he'll be able to come back in. And yeah, I think it's interesting that this shift to a back four exclusively of centre-backs has enabled them to stop letting goals in. And I think it's worth pointing out that although they are all centre-backs, Holgate and Godfrey, who've been filling in as full-backs, they're quite athletic centre-backs. They're quite modern centre-backs. It's not like, you know, sort of four old-school 80s cloggers. You watch them and they don't stick out as centre-backs. But yeah, you know, fair play to Carlo Ancelotti for having found a solution in the absences of Seamus Coleman and Luca Dean. And fair play to Holgate and Godfrey for stepping in and stepping up.
And Sigurdsson?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see him playing all that often this season. When, you know, the clear priority that Everton had during the summer transfer window was to re-dynamise their midfield. And it was a midfield that was in desperate need of shaking up. And it looked like that sort of trio of Allan and Abdoulaye Doucouré and Andre Gomes would be pretty set in stone for the season. But yeah, Sigurdsson's come in and done very well. I mean, I think the fact that Everton have already had a great run of form and then completely collapsed and then come back to have another great run of form does make you wonder how sustainable this is. But they've been really impressive the last few weeks.
Yeah, and I think they're going to have to be a lot more efficient, because what's happening with this change of system, understandably, is that they're creating fewer opportunities. They're not spending as long putting teams under pressure inside the final third. Whereas Dominic Calvert-Lewin, when James Rodriguez was on fire, was maybe getting 3, 4, 5 chances a game. We're not seeing that at the moment. So there's a real reliance on them being ruthless when they get the opportunities, and obviously punishing teams from set plays, which is, they've got a huge strength at set plays at the moment because of those four centre-backs, because of Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin and Doucouré. They're all massive, aren't they? One of the biggest teams in the division. But that might not be so important against West Ham, who are pretty tidy at set pieces themselves.
Mm. West Ham have drawn 3 of their last 4 matches. This match, as I mentioned, sees David Moyes go back to Goodison. He's never won there as a visiting manager, you know.
Just briefly on West Ham, Mikel Antonio made his return from a hamstring injury in their game at Southampton. And he's obviously very important for them. And I think the fact that he has been absent for this slightly sticky run of form that they've had of late isn't any coincidence, because they're a completely different team when he's there. So that'll be a boost. Not sure whether he's fit enough to start, but at least he is. He's fit again.
Just one point on Sigurdsson. I think he really thrives when he's not the main person in a team. When he's kind of like everyone's looking to him to be the to carry a team, he seems to struggle a little bit. But, you know, he's come back into the Everton team and the sort of pressure seems off his shoulders. His penalty against Chelsea, the no-look penalty, is one of the best moments of the season for me. So, yeah, it's good to see him back.
Fascinating. Looking forward to hearing the rest of your best moments of the season so far. Later on, actually, on Friday night, as mentioned, January 1st, it's Man United against Villa, which is ever so exciting. United have moved up into second place behind Liverpool. Villa, though, are on the fringes of the top four with games in hand galore. And they are the team that beat Liverpool 7-2 in undoubtedly one of the highlights of 2020 for Duncan and many of us. It is 11 years since Villa have managed to get a win at Old Trafford, or indeed anywhere against Man United. Crikey, that's a long time. They held Chelsea to that 1-1 draw back on Tuesday. What do you think of this one? Also, Man United looking really consistent, unbeaten in 9 in the Premier League. What's going on there?
I think it's going to be a really exciting game. I do. I love Villa at the moment. They've got great balance in their team. Very solid goalkeeper, of course. Second best save percentage in the division out of all the sort of regular number ones, just behind Nick Pope. The back four is solid. Midfield, Douglas Luiz has made a tremendous difference protecting that back four. And I'm really enjoying this renaissance from El Ghazi. 5 goals in 5 games. A player that didn't get his first start until mid-December. Quite remarkable, really. What's happened here is, with Barkley being out, they've changed from 4-3-3 to 4-2-3-1. El Ghazi likes it on the left. He's right-footed, but he likes it on the left. He's offering great balance, and it's brought Jack Grealish into a central area. And the pair of them, I mean, Duncan probably is across this. Grealish has made 22 chances in the last 4 games from the number 10 position. I mean, he's been brilliant all season, so that's not a huge surprise, perhaps. But El Ghazi, who had to wait for his first start, remember, till mid-December, has had 23 shots in those 4 games. It's just crazy, really, and it's great to see. And I think down the left, Villa can make hay against United, because Target's playing well, McGinn on the left of midfield, sharp, Grealish drifts left, and El Ghazi's on fire. So keep your eye on that portion of the game, because I think they can hurt them there.
Well, also like Traore as well, he's been quite good at just beating players, breaking the lines, and I think that's something that Villa do so well this season, and last season They didn't at all. I mean, they've already scored more goals this season than they did the year they went down in 2015-16. So, yeah, it's going well.
I love that P-roller finish at the Hawthorns. It was just genius, wasn't it, from Traore? That was among my favourite moments of 2020.
So erratic, though. What a year it's been. The game against Wolves when Villa won 1-0, I thought was just summed him up perfectly, Traore. The first half, he was awful. One of the most lamentable collections of first touches you've ever seen. I mean, there was one bit where he tried to play a first-time pass, kicked the ball against his own chest, and ends up sending it the wrong way. And then right at the end of the half, he brought the ball down on the edge of the Wolves penalty area with like the outside of his foot in mid-air and flicked it over an opponent in the same movement. One of the most sublime touches of a football that I've seen in the whole year. And he is that sort of player. He is your kind of classic mercurial winger. I mean, you know, Lyon were quite happy to get a shot of him. He wasn't getting in the team. He didn't feature at all. But he has shown in the last few weeks what a dangerous player he can be when you give him the ball in the right sorts of situations. And just to add to what Adrian was saying, I think the fact that Dean Smith has been able to change the team in recent weeks, bringing in El Ghazi, bringing in Traore, moving Grealish into the middle, and the fact that Villa have carried on picking up points, and actually I think that their current run of form is about as well as they've played all season, I think that is a good sign for Villa, because you might have looked at the early season results and thought, okay, well, perhaps this is just a sort of flash in the pan bit of early season form, but the fact that they're still picking up results, they're still picking up clean sheets, and the manager's able to make changes to the team here and there suggests that there is something really solid there that'll see them through to the end of the season.
They've got cash target in their defence, but they've been a lot less charitable than they were last season.
So they've got the best away defence in the Premier League, actually, I notice. But they have had a long, long time since they managed to get a win against Man United. And just briefly on United, are they now? Is it?
Possibly.
I still don't know. I mean, the evidence
Games unbeaten in the Premier League. They're through to the semi-finals of the Carabao Cup as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can't ignore that evidence. They're 2 points off Liverpool in the table, and they've beaten some good teams. I just tend to think they tend to give teams a chance. We know how often they've had to come from behind. They really laboured to beat Wolves. Wolves were quite unfortunate to lose in the end. Wolves were fantastic first half, and then, as has been the case ever since they lost Raul Jimenez, they just couldn't take any of the chances they created, and they gradually faded out of the game, and Marcus Rashford pops up at the end, Bruno Fernandes with another fantastic assist. But I still think there is a bit of vulnerability to United. There's something a bit gettable about them, but you can't deny the way they're playing. You can't deny the results they're getting. And if this continues, I think you have to consider them as title contenders.
If United fix their off the ball work, they're contenders. But if they carry on in this same plane, there's too much. At the moment, they need 3 goals to win games, and that definitely isn't sustainable.
Well, they didn't on Tuesday.
Well, they didn't. No, that was a different type of game against Wolves. You're right, but no. In general, they're leaking too many.
Yeah. Okay, well, they are through to the semi-finals of the Carabao Cup. We'll get a quick word on that tournament, those quarterfinals from last week, and a big throw forward to Spurs Leeds next.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Carabao Cup quarterfinals. Man United beat Everton. They're going to take on in the semi-finals, which should be in the first week of January. They're going to take on the Man City side that eviscerated Arsenal. Spurs, meantime, saw off Stoke, and they'll get the Brentford team that beat Newcastle. These will be one-off semi-finals. The final has been rescheduled to the 25th of April in the hope that some fans may be able to turn up. And the winner, of course, will be, excitingly enough, included in the UEFA Europa Conference League, which is new.
It's unfortunate that in the UK, the conference already has a football meaning and not a positive one.
No.
I suspect around Europe another word.
I don't think the word conference has a positive. Like, I'm going to the conference.
It doesn't have a glamorous meaning, does it?
No.
Quite the opposite.
You didn't see Wickham strolls the title in 92, 93, clearly. So.
Anyway, Adrian, Brentford. This is their first major semi-final in their entire 131-year history.
Yeah, it's a remarkable run for them, and it's much deserved. They wiped the floor with Newcastle, really, didn't they? And they did so with an understrength side. So this is Brentford, I would imagine, will pick their A team against Spurs. But yeah, they can't be underestimated. Very positive, attack-minded team. Lots of talent in forward areas. But for me, defensively, they're actually weaker than they were last year. And I'm not actually convinced that they'll get promoted from the Championship. I think they might have been a little bit stronger 12 months ago. But on a one-off game, if Spurs aren't at it, Brentford have a chance.
Okay, they've already knocked out four Premier League teams this season, which is not bad going, particularly given how many of their top stars they've sold off to Premier League outfits. Anyway, you can hear more about the Bees in the Totally Football League show, which is out sometime around now, Wednesday night, Thursday morning. And also in that show, of course, they'll be touching on the big shock news at Sheffield Wednesday. Tony Pulis sacked after just 10 games in charge. Let's move on, though, to Spurs, who have a very intriguing clash with Leeds coming up on Saturday lunchtime, 12:30. Leeds very much on a hot streak right now. Spurs, meanwhile, with this growing feeling among many observers that there's a bit of a tactical issue, particularly in their second half performances, where they lie very much bottom of the Premier League in terms of shots attempted.
Yeah, I mean, they landed on a very successful formula in the first weeks of the season, was in that they would score early, and I think they still, over the course of the season, have scored more goals in the first 30 minutes of matches than pretty much anyone except for Man City, I think. And then they would sit back and pick teams off on the counter-attack, and it worked brilliantly. And what's been happening of late is that they're still scoring, but they're just not building on that. We saw that in the game at Palace. We saw that in the game at Wolves. And you kind of feel like teams have figured them out a little bit. And yeah, I thought Mourinho's interview after the Wolves game was an absolute Mourinho classic. He was asked about four different questions and replied to all of them by saying, "Oh, you know, I probably can't answer this." Sort of making it seem that he was, defending his players despite the fact that they had disappointed him in such a grave way. But I think the fact that this pattern keeps repeating itself suggests that, okay, maybe there's an element of fatigue, and Premier League players just across the board do look extremely tired and leggy at the moment. But I think that, you know, the fact that this isn't only happening every now and again, but week after week, that for me is a clear sign that it's a managerial failing as well.
Yeah, you're totally right about it's too cautious. I mean, if we remember what Mourinho was famous for at Chelsea in his first spell, it was going 2-0 up and then defending, and that worked, because as we know, 2-0 is not a dangerous lead in the slightest.
Controversy klaxon.
But then it seems to have been sparked by the slightly more dangerous 3-0 lead, because that West Ham game, when they were 3-0 up and then drew 3-3, Mourinho does seem to have, you know, gone into his laundry basket and back to basics since then.
Yeah, I've got a stat. I did a piece on Spurs earlier in the week analysing this change of style, or the style that he's implemented. And I threw it back to Pochettino, kind of peak Pochettino. Let's call it 2017-18. Where they had 27 touches inside the opposition box per match. It's down to 17 touches inside the box per match now. That's a huge 36% drop. They're ranked 17th, by the way, for touches inside the opposition box. And in terms of chances created from open play, a 42% downturn since 2017.
You sound like Mikel Arteta.
Yeah, I do a little bit, but although hopefully my maths makes a little bit more sense than Mikel's, because, yeah, I didn't get where he was coming from there. But you get my drift. They're very, very reliant on converting chances, and they've been brilliant at it this season. They have to start finding a way to ask more questions of opposition teams, because the goals will dry up.
Well, the curious thing is that here they're taking on Leeds, who themselves showed a slightly unexpected kind of chameleon-esque tactical approach in their clash with Burnley when they went a goal up and then defended it in a kind of classic Jose fashion. So we know Bielsa can change, can move. What do you think?
No. is my answer to that. I mean, I think this will be the most interesting game of the weekend in many ways, in that we know what to expect. We know that Leeds will attack because that's what Leeds do. I mean, yes, they played within themselves against Burnley, but that was having taken the lead and sort of trying to see the game out, I think. We know that Spurs will defend and look to hit Leeds on the break. And I think if Spurs can get an early goal, as they have done quite frequently this season, and then withstand the barrage of Leeds attacks, I do think there is, there's a way for Spurs to win this game, but there is also a danger of them being completely swept away, because if Leeds play with the sort of verve and the sort of attacking impetus that we've seen from them of late in that game against West Brom and the game against Newcastle, even the game against Man United when they got thrashed at Old Trafford, then they could get a result here.
Mourinho's won all four of his meetings with Marcelo Bielsa, although those were all back in La Liga when he had Real Madrid and Bielsa was running Athletic Bilbao. It's a slight mismatch, you might feel, or perhaps that's the equivalent of Spurs against Leeds. I don't know. What do you think? Do you share Tom's optimism from Spurs' point of view, Duncan?
I mean, part of me thinks Kane and Son has not really done much recently. I mean, Josh Brownhill at Burnley's had more shots than Son in December, which possibly isn't ideal for Tottenham. So, I mean, this is the game where they could click back into life. I mean, the question no one's really addressed at Spurs is Gareth Bale. You know, they're paying him a lot of money and he's not... He scored one goal in the Premier League and done a bit in the Europa League, but, you know, did okay
who,
against
who
Stoke.
Who would have thought he'd spend a lot of the season injured?
Yeah. I mean, he looked okay at Stoke in the Carabao Cup, but, you know, they're a Championship team and then he got injured. So, I mean, they really do need a spell of consistency from him. I saw Marca were being quite scathing to him this morning.
What did they
not
say,
sure
Duncan?
They were generous. They were just saying, ha-ha, we were right. Tottenham was wrong.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the game, James. I think it's going to be a cracker. And yeah, I hope that Leeds play with the same sort of enterprise that we saw at the Hawthorns. I just wanted to flag up a player that I think might be one of the most underrated or underappreciated in the league, and that's Jack Harrison. Jack Harrison. No one really talks about Jack Harrison, but in recent weeks he scored two worldies, absolute beauties, into the top corner. And in terms of creating chances for teammates, only three players have done a better job in the Premier League this season. You might have heard of them: De Bruyne, Fernandes, and Grealish. Jack Harrison, his output on the left-hand side for Leeds is very, very good. And look, I think Gareth Southgate must be looking at him with a bit of interest because he's got in product.
Wow. Leeds have already scored more Premier League goals this season, this from Duncan, than they did in the whole of their campaign in 96-97 under George Graham. Who'd have thought? Anyway,
crazy, but crazy. True.
Also on Saturday, well, Arsenal at West Brom, as we mentioned earlier, but also a couple of interesting games: Palace against Sheffield United and Brighton Wolves. Sheffield United, who have now got 2 points from 16, that's never been done before, Duncan. Other numbers that illustrate how far they're off the bottom of the worst team ever charts?
Well, I mean, up until now, I mean, as a lot of people were chanting in the street, Bolton 1902-03 were the worst starters at this stage with 3 points. But yeah, Sheffield United, it's weird with Sheffield United. Their XG is only fifth worst. They're above Wolves in terms of XG this season. So they're creating chances. They're only losing games narrowly. They've lost 11 of their games this season by one goal. The record in the Premier League is 15 in a season. So they've got ample time to smash that record. So yes, they're in an almost unbelievably bad position, but I don't think they're not the worst team in the Premier League. There's still a slight chance they could get out of it, but
who's worse than them in the Premier League?
I would say West Brom are definitely worse.
Are Palace worse than them right now? Palace, who got done 10-0 in two games prior to that 1-1 with Leicester. Palace, who have talks surrounding the future of their manager and suggestions that Eddie Howe might make a belated appearance on the bench for them.
Yeah, I mean, Palace have got the propensity to collapse, as we said, and their defence isn't good. So if Sheffield United are going to solve their attacking issues, then this could be finally the game to do it. But yeah, I do feel a bit sorry for them because, you know, they were always going to struggle a little bit this season compared to last year, but no one envisaged this.
It is so weird, Sheffield United season. As Duncan says, I mean, they are historically one of the worst teams we've ever seen, But you can't compare them to a, you know, a Derby County 07, 08 or any of the dreadful Sunderland teams that we've seen. I mean, every time I watch them, I think they still look like a good team. They're just missing a goal scorer and they let in avoidable goals. But for me, there is an enormous disconnect between their performance level and the points they're getting on the board. And yeah, I mean, they do look dead and buried. But at the same time, there is a sort of... there's a consistency of performance, I think, that suggests to me that they're not that far away from turning some of these narrow defeats into draws and then perhaps even into wins eventually.
Yeah, wow. There's nothing shambolic about Sheffield United, is there? And that is a compliment, really. They won't want it, but they're not a shambles. So you've got to give them some chance of turning it around sooner rather than later.
11 points. Has that ever been done before? Has that escape ever been made? 11 points adrift?
Yeah, there's been bigger escapes than that at this stage of the season. We're only 16 games in, it's, you know. But the point is that, you know, 11 points is also the record low in Premier League history with Derby, and that's their first target, I would say, because this team doesn't deserve to be the worst team in Premier League history. I think if they just imagine, if they kind of start preparing for the Championship, maybe the pressure will go off and they'll start to get some results.
Okay. Alex Cooney asks if relegation this year is being driven by the teams that bought the worst in the summer. Alex mentions Brewster, Ramsdale and Burke at Sheffield United and the lack of investment at West Brom, but also Lallana at Brighton. Brighton, who are up against Wolves in the Saturday tea time fixture. Would they be in your list of teams that are worse actually than Sheffield United if you don't look at the actual results, Duncan?
Not really. I mean, again, their underlying numbers are much better than their results suggest. I'm pretty sure Brighton have uncovered some sort of South Downs-based chalk curse because they're so unlucky. I mean, as Adrian said earlier, they played well against Arsenal at times, but then lost, and they really... You know, everyone could admire Graham Potter's philosophy, a bit like people did with Eddie Howe's philosophy, but ultimately the greatest philosophy in football is getting 3 points, and they really need to do that soon.
On Brighton and the philosophy of Graham Potter, I just feel it's run out of a little bit of momentum. There was no distinct identity to their performance against Arsenal. Yeah, they contained them very well in the first half, and defensively they were strong, but... throughout the course of that match, there was no cohesion in the way that Brighton attacked. They didn't look dangerous at all. And it was a very odd team selection as well. He left out Mopay and Welbeck. So yeah, I'm not as convinced that Brighton will end up in the mid-table position that a lot of people feel they deserve. There's something not quite right about them at the moment. If you take Yves Bissouma out of that Brighton team, I'm telling you now, they're in big trouble.
But they might be in big trouble anyway. They're in 17th place, not all looking that good for Brighton. They've only had one win at home in the whole of 2020 and must try and get a second one at the start of this new year when they host Wolves on January 2nd. Woof. Next up, let's talk about a club where there's good news galore, Burnley.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Sunday's fixtures, listener, possibly Chelsea Man City. Rather more likely that we'll be seeing Newcastle, Leicester and Burnley up against Fulham. Burnley where a sudden turn of form, one defeat and 3 wins in the last 5 games, has lifted the Clarets clear of the bottom three. And it's also been matched by some very interesting developments off the field too, with talk, as you may have heard this week, of a takeover by American sports investment firm ALK, possibly completing before the game on Sunday with Fulham. What's going on? Let's hear from The Athletic's Burnley correspondent, Andy Jones. Andy, thank you so much for joining us again. This is crucially, as I understand it, this is the right one of the two consortiums, the one that featured Mohamed El Kashashi and Chris Farnell pulled out the race last week. These guys are brighter prospects, are they, for the Clarets? What do you think it means in terms of investment and for Sean Dyche's position?
Well, ALK Capital have throughout have said, you know, Dice is a big part of their plans moving forwards. And you look at what he's done for the club in his eight plus years at the helm now, and how he's taken them from a championship team to an established Premier League side, and they want to back him. The idea was to be in place for the January transfer market so that they could, you know, invest. There's not going to be, you know, a bucket load of cash. They're not going to throw a load of money at it, but, you know, it's going to be a sensible investment. But they're going to look to try and back the manager, which is why one of the key things for them when they first come through the door is to make sure that, you know, is to get the chance to speak to him. They haven't spoken to him yet. They're not allowed access to the club until they've officially taken over. You know, they want to invest, and they want to try and move and take Burnley to that next level, because I think, you know, as well as Mike Garlick ran the club and the current board, you know, Burnley will run so sustainably and very healthily, and the finances show that year on year, posting profits. But it just felt, and you look at the last few transfer windows and sort of the lack of investment in the summer, you know, only £2 million spent on two players, Dale Stevens and Will Norris, when the squad needed a little bit more, and Dice was open and sort of said that they needed two or three more. And, you know, ALK have sort of made it clear that they want to come in and try and take the club to the next step forward, and they want to be active in the January transfer market, which is, you know, which should fill Burnley fans with a lot of optimism.
Andy, Sean Dyche has been at pains to say that, yeah, he welcomes this news, but has said we need to bring in the right type of players. What are the right type of players for Burnley? And are there any strong rumours, you know, going around at the moment as to who they might target in January?
It's very difficult, yeah, because sort of as I said, the new owners haven't been able to speak today. So one of the things Alan Pace did, who's sort of heading the ALK bid, was when he was sort of in discussions over the takeover, he spoke to the current board about what sort of the January transfer plans were, to sort of align strategies, and so he had the best, as much knowledge as he could possibly have, so when he comes in, when, you know, this, you know, is all agreed, he can sort of on day one look to make things happen and try and move things forward. You know, it's quite clear that Burnley sort of need to strengthen out wide. The Leeds game recently showed that they had no wingers available, all three were injured, and also sort of to bulk up the central defensive units behind sort of Ben Mee and James Tarkowski. They're the two areas I think he'll be targeting, but it's difficult to know, because now there's new investment, those January transfer plans of the current board will probably change a little bit, and it might open the door a little bit to some players who may not have been gettable, if that makes sense. But they're going to look to be active and try and, you know, just bulk up the squad, because Burnley for a while now have been, you know, sort of running on thin numbers, and injuries haven't helped with sort of a continuous flow of injuries, which is, you look at the bench yesterday, there were five sort of first team players missing, and when they get them back, the squad looks strong, but just, you know, the idea is to just make it a little bit stronger, to try and, now they've sort of got away from the relegation zone a little bit, to try and, you know, sustain that and keep them moving in the right direction and picking up points.
Andy, the remarkable thing is that, as you mentioned, five starters out midweek, but this has come against a backdrop of this run of form that's, since that win over Palace in late November, I think it's really only been that hammering against Man City. They've beaten Arsenal, they've beaten Wolves as well. What's been behind that run of success?
I think, I mean, they've got players back. They started the season with, you know, sort of a number of injuries. I think they had sort of seven squad players out at least. You know, Ben Mee has been massive since he's come back in. He's, you know, the form's drastically changed. James Tarkowski was struggling with an injury as well at the start of the season. They're both fit. They're both, you know, on top form. Nick Pope behind them. That sort of triangle's very much the base and the foundation of Burnley's play, and they can build from that. And it was about them finding the balance, and over the past, you know, few weeks, sort of, they've managed to find the balance in terms of keeping it out at one end and scoring enough goals, because goals were the problem early on, but they've managed to find, you know, ways to get them, and Chris Wood and Ashley Barnes are coming into a bit of form as well. They look a lot more like the Burnley you know and expect, which they didn't at the start of the season. There was mistakes creeping in. They didn't really look, you know, they just looked undercooked a little bit. Whereas now they look up and running, and Burnley are very much a momentum team. All credit to them, and all credit to Dyche for, you know, sticking with them, keeping faith, and the players have sort of retained the favour, and they're looking a lot more healthy position in the league, and now, you know, set to be off the pitch as well.
Andy Jones, The Athletic's Burnley correspondent. Exciting times then, with Fulham arriving this Sunday. Crikey. Now, Monday, there's a game as well. It's Saints-Liverpool. Should we have a quick word about Liverpool? Should we have a quick word about Saints? They've gone a little bit off the boil. A 1-1 at Arsenal, a 1-0 defeat against City, then back-to-back goalless draws at Fulham and against West Ham. Is that something that Saints fans should be concerned about? And Liverpool, they've had the odd stutter as well. A 1-1 draw at Fulham and that 1-1 with Big Sam's West Brom. Again, should they be concerned? When's Thiago back? What do you think?
Well, Thiago is apparently back pretty soon, and I think that will make a massive difference to those games like the West Brom game. You imagine Thiago in that match threading balls through. I think West Brom would have found it a lot harder, particularly towards the end of the match. So that would be a massive win for Liverpool. I mean, it's weird. Thiago still hasn't made his home debut for Liverpool, even though he signed at the end of the summer, which is strange. But yeah, I think Liverpool are fine. Even, you know, their points total when they haven't been playing that well is still more than everyone else. Yeah, I mean, the big game on the horizon is obviously they play Manchester United in a few weeks, and it could be a retro Liverpool United title clash, which would be good.
Woof. Okay, 2 points between them. And Saints, they're in ninth place, which is really not too bad at all. Very good. Well, I know we're all excited to hear everybody's moments of 2020. Just a little bit longer before we can get to that. First of all, always good to get some odds on the football coming up from Lee Price of Paddy Power.
Hello, listeners. Hope you're well. I'm here with the final list of betting odds 2020. For anyone not interested, fair enough, may I point you to the skip button on your screen? All the best. Right, now it's just us friends here. Let's get to the numbers. The David Moyes but when he's good derby takes place on Friday, with both Everton and West Ham eyeing Europe as greedily as Nigel Farage. Everton the favourites here at 5-6, but the real story is Moyes himself, who hasn't landed in the top 10 for almost as long as Florence and the Machine. Remember them? Straight after that match is United versus Villa, which should equal goals, but as anyone who fell asleep during the last Old Trafford fixture can attest, it could well equal an on-pitch lockdown where neither team is allowed out of their own half except for essentials, or something like that anyway. United are favourites at 4-6, which means Villa must be value at 10-3. And if you do fancy a goal fest, you can get 3-1 on there being 5 or more goals in this one. And finally, to the relegation 6-pointer that only exists in Big Sam's head, West Brom get draws against Man City and Liverpool, but couldn't resist the best team ever, Leeds United, last time out. It's 8-15 they lose again to Arsenal. Back-to-back victories for the Gunners meant that Arsenal fan TV had Christmas off. And it's 5-1 that the Baggies plunge Mikel Arteta's men back into crisis, or 3-1 that Big Sam gets another draw. Happy New Year, listeners. Thank you for allowing me to impinge on your favourite podcast this series, although even I've skipped at this point. Ugh, never mind. Bye-bye.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Well then, Tom Duncan, Adrian, bit of 2020 vision, eh? With your best moments. Tom, you've got your hand up already.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna flag up. We've not talked about Newcastle Leicester. I don't know whether you wanted to.
But well, there you go. Maybe this will be one of our highlights of 2021.
To talk about it, but I'm just flagging it up in case it has
you're absolutely right.
Overlooked.
We'll be recording. We'll be coming together to record on Sunday night off the back very much of that and other fixtures. And we'll certainly be looking forward to getting into that one. But indulge me, if you will, now with some of your highlights from what has been, well, an extraordinary year in so many ways, not least for football. Do you have particular things that do you want me to throw a few out there? Your Bayern Barcelona 8-2, your Eric Dier racing into the stands to confront an angry fan. Your how about this one? Something I'd completely forgotten. Man City's Champions League ban. Do you remember when they got banned from the Champions League?
Oh, yeah.
That was this year. Extraordinary. Anyway, what you got then? Duncan.
I enjoyed Barnsley completing their first unbeaten April since 1934, mainly because they didn't play any games because of lockdown, but that, you know, something to chalk up. Bayern winning as many games in the Champions League as Crystal Palace did in all competitions was quite good last season. Obviously, personally for me, seeing Wickham beat Oxford, Joe Jacobson penalty, the true Oxford vaccine in my eyes, putting us up into tier two. Brighton losing a game. We mentioned earlier Brighton being incredibly unlucky. Losing a game with a goal that came after the final whistle, which I've never seen before, seemed particularly harsh. And then obviously not a moment in itself, but you know, after Maradona died and all the tributes and all the, you know, memories, that was one of the most kind of amazing weeks or two I've ever had with football. You know, seeing stuff I've never seen before, seeing tributes from people, you know, from his childhood and stuff. That was a, you know, obviously extremely sad, but an incredible moment.
Not from Adrian, though. Adrian went with a story about him being angry in his pyjamas, memorably.
I did, yeah. Was that distasteful? Giving everybody the broader picture of the complexity of Maradona's life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that, lovely moments there, Duncan. Adrian, what stood out for you?
Well, a couple of big famous wins. Watford beating Liverpool to make sure that they weren't going to be invincibles. That was
because of the Arsenal angle.
That
right.
was huge. Yeah, because a lot of Arsenal fans were very, very nervous.
Was that the biggest moment Arsenal had this year? When Watford beat.
I love Villa spanking Liverpool was unbelievable, and Villa Park was probably home to the most controversial moment in my eyes, right. and that's the Hawkeye breakdown. Yeah. With that goal, that was ridiculous, quite frankly. Not the technology breaking down, but it was ridiculous that VAR didn't step in and make sure that goal wasn't given.
I should just leap in and say, of course, Arsenal have had plenty of big moments apart from that Watford win, because they won two bits of silverware this year, didn't they?
That's my favourite moment of 2020 is undoubtedly Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang dropping the FA Cup. It was a truly calamitous moment, because he made the same mistake not once, not twice, about three, maybe four times. And it just struck me that this is probably someone that grew up in, you know, in Gabon, and maybe getting to watch the odd FA Cup final, but clearly he'd never stuck around for the trophy lift.
Just to disagree, isn't this specifically because of COVID, though? Because normally they unscrew that bit from the bottom so they can lift it up. But he was left to his own devices because they didn't have anyone helping the winning captain.
But
so.
Anyone that's watched football in their life knows that you don't lift the FA Cup by the plinth. It's just too shaky. You take it off and it was a comedy moment on the back of a great performance actually from Arsenal that shouldn't be forgotten in that sort of cup final where there were no fans. Such a sort of strange environment. But yeah, Aubameyang dropping the cup, that was my favourite moment.
Tom?
I've quite enjoyed being able to hear what's going on the pitch, which has been one of the few upsides to games being played behind closed doors.
Kepa!
Personal highlights include Newcastle's Matt Ritchie being caught saying to a linesman, "How have you given that, you wee dick?" which I thought was actually quite restrained as insults go. And also Rob Holding complaining that Adama Traore had gone down too easily for someone who was built like a brick house. Again, to use his words. And also just sort of the banality of things like just hearing how footballers call for the ball by shouting each other's names. I mean, of course they do. That's how everyone demands the ball. But there's something about hearing, you know, superstar footballers shouting at each other in the same way that you might expect to hear on Hackney Marshes on a Sunday morning. That's quite amusing. From a sort of Premier League results perspective, I think Adrian mentioned Liverpool losing 7-2 at Villa Park on the same day that Man United lost 6-1 at home to Tottenham, October the 4th. I don't think there has ever been two more eyebrow-raising results on the same day in the entire Premier League era. And if I have to pick out one individual moment from the whole year, it would be Lionel Messi's dummy that set up Antoine Griezmann to score against Real Betis in November. Not sure if you remember this one. Cross comes into the box from the left, and Messi, the ball, the goalkeeper, and two defenders all converge at the near post, and Messi jumps over the ball and gives Griezmann a tap-in. And I watched it quite a lot, and it has the beautiful audacity of a magic trick, because the ball's coming in and you can only see Messi attempting to score from it, and then he steps over the ball leaves the way clear for Griezmann. And it reminds me of the, as it reminded plenty of people, I'm sure, of the famous Pelé dummy against Uruguay at the 1970 World Cup. But of all the football things that I've watched this year, I think that put the biggest smile on my face.
Oh, brilliant. All right. Well, but many other highlights that no doubt listeners would have, like Liverpool winning the title, Scotland qualifying for their first major tournament since France 98 when they booked their passage to Euro 2020. Coxie winning the Intertotally was another massive highlight, and Jack Lang's comeuppance. And probably also, I mean, certainly one of the most...
controversy-tinged tournament, that it has to be said.
Right. And speaking of controversy, one of the most extraordinary moments of 2020, probably the recent Champions League game when the PSG and Basaksehir teams both left the field after those words from the fourth official to the Basaksehir assistant manager. The fallout of which, I guess, is ongoing. Did UEFA ever come up with a verdict on that?
I think we're still waiting for UEFA's verdict.
All right, then. Well, it has been an extraordinary 12 months. Alex Cooney says if they do go ahead with the two-week COVID break, would you guys be continuing the year-by-year Champions League series? I'll definitely need the podcast fix. Alex, of course we will continue. We'll probably throw in a Intertotally Community Shield in there as well, or something. But anyway, fingers crossed it doesn't come to that. Whatever you've been doing during your year, many thanks for keeping it totally. And we look forward to 2021 and all the football it brings. Many thanks to Tom and Adrian and Duncan for being with us today. Anything else you want to add before we wrap this up for this year?
No. Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year to you as well, Adrian and Tom and Duncan, and to producer Charlie. So often up into the wee small hours, pasting it all together from bits of old clips. And you, most of all, listener, of course, do join us again then on Monday, the 4th of January, as we begin this brand new year. Have a special New Year's Eve, and we'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.